Welcome back to the show. It's the first one of 2026, and we're off to such a great start, aren't we? We're doing so great in 2026. And just, boy, we just left the stink of 2025 behind, and we walked into a whole new world, and everything's coming up daisies in this new year. Nothing going wrong. I was just talking to the TikTok Digital Studio audience, they're all here, about how crazy the last two Januaries have been. Like, I don't know if you guys remember how bad January 2025 was. That was the month where, like, as soon as Doge came in with the wrecking crew of 19 and 18 year old interns who were just firing anyone and everyone in the government, and they fired all the people who make sure that air traffic is safe, and all the planes were crashing and everything, and they were like, nah, we didn't do that. That has nothing to do with what we just did. And they were like firing people who were in charge of our nuclear codes and stuff, and then they were like, oh shit, we gotta hire those people back. And it was just like pure chaos. Like, we just went into 2025 and it was just immediately like, oh god, this is gonna suck so much. Like, he did the Sig Heil at the inauguration, and you know, I feel like we all made it through year one of Trump 2.0, and it was like, okay, that was really bad, but here we go. Oh, second year, and like right off the bat, oh my god, what a month January has already been. And right now, as I'm recording this, it's only January 12th. We're not even halfway through the month. Oh, my god. But let's do it. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today on the show, we are talking about the morality and ethics of self-defense. Okay, why this topic? Well, obviously, the hot thing that is all over the internet is the murder of Renee Nicole Good by an ICE agent who shot her in cold blood 3 times in the face, in her car, in front of her wife, in front of her community. And we will come back to that. We will be breaking down the evidence, breaking down the footage, and breaking down all of the, you know, the ins and outs of that. But I want to start here with this video from The Soy Pill, which is a channel on YouTube that I'm a fan of. I really like a lot of what The Soy Pill puts out. This isn't a Soy Pill hit piece. So The Soy Pill, if you happen to see this, I'm a fan, but The Soy Pill recently put out a video about the professional victim economy that exists exclusively on the right. We don't have this on the left, but on the right they have these like professional victim grifters, and it's people like this girl who just had her essay rejected by the professor at Oklahoma University because she wrote an absolutely dog shit terrible essay that sounded like it was written by a third grader. But because her teacher was trans, and because her teacher was like an enemy to the conservative ideology, and because the bad essay that she wrote was like arguing for a biblical interpretation of gender, even though that's not what the assignment was. The assignment wasn't write an essay about what the Bible has to say on gender. That just wasn't what the assignment was. But because she was a victim of the woke left, the right is doing what they do, and they're giving her the keys to the kingdom. Basically, the world is her oyster now. They're like, what do you want to be CEO of? How much money do you want? Like, you tell us. We're raising you all the money on all of the GoFundMes. This is, you know, this is a very, very common, very lucrative, very successful grift that conservative people have been running for years, and it's only conservatives that do this. Like, this doesn't happen on the left where it's just like, oh, something like this person was a victim of like right-wing bigotry or right-wing hatred or right-wing violence, therefore we're going to put them on a speaking circuit and make them a multimillionaire. We're going to give them a podcast. We're going to make sure they have their own segment on CNN. Like this doesn't happen, but it's a very common thing on the right. And I would recommend actually watching this video from The Soy Pill, because I think mostly it's a good video. But this was one of those weird things where, like, I was out for my morning walk and I was listening to this video, and he said a few things that caught me off guard. And one of them has to do with the topic of our show, self-defense, and it's the thing that gave me the idea for this. But since we're on the topic of the video, I want to talk about the first thing that he said that I was kind of like, Huh. He was talking about professional victim grifters. And obviously, when you talk about professional conservative victim grifters, you can't do that without talking about Riley Gaines.
Let's start off with Riley Gaines. As already mentioned, Riley Gaines tied for fifth against trans swimmer Leah Thomas in a race. Now, some of you may get mad at me for this one, but I don't think her original grievance is entirely misplaced.
I don't think her initial grievance is entirely misplaced. I do. She tied for fifth. Four cisgender women beat both of them. She would have taken fifth, whether Leah Thomas had been there or not. This is like the shining example of why it's unfair for trans women to compete in sports. And it's a cisgender swimmer tying for fifth. And her biggest grievance is that they didn't have two fifth place trophies available on the day. And so she had to suffer the indignity of being pictured holding a sixth place trophy that looked identical to the fifth place trophy. And later on, they gave her a fifth place trophy. But like, that's it. What validity could there possibly be? But he goes on to say this.
Biological men, on average, are going to naturally outperform women in just about every sport, save for target shooting, long distance endurance running, and boob smashing.
Okay, so first of all, I don't like the phrase biological men. It's just, you know, there's no such thing as a non-biological person. Every person is biological. I don't like it. Cisgender, transgender. Do you identify as the gender you were assigned at birth, or do you not? This whole, like, are you a biological man? You don't know what the fuck's going on in anybody's body. Just because a person has external sex characteristics, physiological sex characteristics that are usually categorized as like one sex or the other, you don't know what's going on internally. You don't know their hormonal distribution. You don't know their chromosomal orientation. Intersex variations exist, and a lot of people have intersex variations that they're not even aware of because they never test for them. You come out of the womb and they look at one external facing sex characteristic, that external facing genitalia that is visible to the naked eye, and they say, they give you an assignment. They assign you male or female. They don't know what's going on the inside. They don't know if a person with external male genitalia has internal female genitalia. They don't know. They don't check. They don't know what your chromosomal orientation is. They don't know what your hormonal distribution is. They don't know what your developmental pattern is going to be. Sometimes people are born with one anatomical orientation and then their developmental pattern through puberty. But then he names just like a few sports. He's like, on average, biological men are going to beat women in every single sport. And he names like four things. It's a very incomplete list. He doesn't talk about fencing, darts, archery, race car driving, bowling, curling, gymnastics, competitive dance, equestrian show jumping, several disciplines of competitive climbing, long distance swimming, ice skating. And then there are several sports that can't really be compared, like basketball. This is something that people don't really talk about very often. You're kind of comparing two different sports at that point. But one thing that doesn't change are like fundamentals, like passing and touch and just like your shooting. You know, like it would be hard to argue that Caitlin Clark doesn't have the same fundamental mechanics when it comes to her passing and her vision on the court and her shooting as someone like Steph Curry. Like, she's in that realm. They're shooting from the same place. She can hit a logo three with the best of them. She can throw a full court pass with the best of them. There's nothing about like her gender that is prohibiting her from being good at the fundamentals of that game. I think that what's going on here is the soy pill is just thinking of sports where the objective of the sport is to physically dominate your opponent with your size and muscle mass. And that's just sort of thinking about sports in a very narrow-minded, male-centric lens. And if you actually expand the lens of the competitive world of competitive athletics. It's a much wider landscape than that. And he sort of makes some assertions here about how, like, well, the whole reason we had to do this in the first place was to protect women. And that's not true either. Like, what was happening in a lot of the sports that I just listed is that women were outcompeting men, and the men who ran things were just like, well, we can't have that. So we must make them two different categories. We must make them two separate things because we can't have the women beating the men in the sports.
So if we let trans women who have gone through male puberty compete at the highest levels, you're going to start eroding the very reason we have sex-segregated categories in the first place, to let women win in competitive sports in spite of their sexually dimorphic disadvantage.
You're going to start eroding the very reason we have sex-segregated categories in the first place. If you're going to make a claim like that, you've got all your work cut out for you. This is the exact same as people who just basically, they just say, it's common sense that cisgender women are not safe in women's locker rooms and women's bathrooms with trans women. Like, there's nothing bigoted about that. It's just common sense that they are not safe. And it's like, well, no, it's not. It's actually not common sense. And if you are going to claim that, you've got all your work cut out for you. You need to show me substantive data that proves your assertion that they are no longer safe, that cisgender women are not safe in the company of transgender women. Because I think the way that a lot of people go about this is they just argue it as though, like, obviously, right? Obviously. Come on, let's be reasonable. And that's what I think he's trying to do here. And that's the, like, I said that I agree with this channel like 95% of the time. And the other 5% is, I think sometimes he falls into the trap of trying to be like the reasonable leftist, like the person on the left who's like, I can admit when we're being a little silly. I can admit when the left goes a little far. And he's trying to throw a bone to people on the right to be like, I get it when we overstep. But when you give them these victories, especially in spaces like trans women competing in sports, and you go like, no, I get it. We got to make sure we keep everything fair. First of all, show me your work. You've got all of your work cut out for you. You need to show me substantive data that this is happening en masse across the world, that cisgender women are being robbed of titles that are being taken from them again and again and again by transgender women, that cisgender women are being injured in their sports by transgender women at an alarming rate. You need to show me substantive data. You can't just say, obviously, that's what's going to happen. Because now you're in the same space of people being like, well, we can't just let black people into white communities. Obviously, that's not going to go well. Obviously, we're not going to be safe. Okay, show your work then. Or is it just that you're just prejudiced? You're making a very prejudiced assumption about a historically marginalized group of people that has no substantive data or to empirically back it up. You need to actually like show your work when you make claims like that. Otherwise, you're just spreading baseless propaganda and doing the right's work for them. Fairness and protection, right? A couple things about that I always talk about with this topic is sports are inherently unfair. Sports are inherently dangerous. They always have been. They always will be. Is somebody objectively breaking the rules? Did Lance Armstrong take performance-enhancing drugs when it's against the rules to do so? You know, are the New England Patriots filming the practices of other teams illegally and like stealing like knowledge about their plays and their game plan? Are you cheating? Okay, yeah, there are rules around like a certain degree of fairness. But when we're talking about trans women competing in sports, and it's always trans women, not trans men, nobody cares about the trans men who are competing in men's sports. But when we're talking about trans women competing in sports, it always comes down to this, like, physiologically, is it fair? Do you have some kind of physiological advantage? And the only time in sports we ever talk about that is in this circumstance. Like, sports have physiological, different athletes in different sports have physiological advantages. Someone just having longer legs than someone else and them just being better at sprinting because their gait is longer. So for every step they take, they're taking like 6 inches further than their opponent and they just have a physiological advantage. That's just something. Sometimes people are just born that way. Sometimes you just got Michael Phelps, who it's like, it doesn't matter how hard anyone else in this pool has worked for their entire life. I was born with longer arms than you, and I was born with webbed toes and like lungs that don't need to breathe as often as yours do. And I just was born with like freakish physiological advantages, and no one gives a shit. Nobody cares because that's what sports are. And then there are these things like X factors to sports. There's no reason why, looking at Tom Brady on paper, he should be the greatest football player of all time. It doesn't make sense. He doesn't seem to like have the like clear physiological advantages of like, oh yeah, I mean, God, he's, you know, 7 feet tall and like 300 pounds, and he runs like a 4.440. Like, he can throw the ball 100 yards. Like, he's got all, like, he's literally like an Olympian god. It's like, no, he's just kind of like an average sized guy for a football player. But there are these intangibles. There's this sort of like, like X factor of like attitude and confidence and knowledge of the game and just vision, being able to just see the game in a way that other people can't. There are all kinds of advantages physically and psychologically. And then outside of the physiological advantages, there are sociological advantages. How much wealth were you born into? Did your family have the resources to train you at the best gyms with the best trainers, with the best teachers? Did you go to a really good school where you had access to really great facilities and really great coaches? These things have always existed in sports. Nobody cares about them. Nobody's going on a campaign being like, hold on. Let's be realistic here. If your parents were in a certain tax bracket, that's not fair. You can't be out there competing against kids whose parents were like on food stamps. That's not fair. We gotta have different categories for people who were raised in different tax brackets. Nobody gives a shit about the fair unless it's a trans woman. All of a sudden, when it's a trans woman, it's like, well, hold on here. That's not fair. I always talk about the fact that Spud Webb played in the NBA with Shaquille O'Neal. Spud Webb was 5'3 and like 130 pounds. Shaquille O'Neal was 7'2 and like 350 pounds. Tell me how that works. Why is that fair? Because they both got a dick and balls? That's it? Hey, long as they both got the same equipment downstairs, it's all fair. If you look at the NBA, like, people who are 6'2 look short on the court. Like, people who are 6'2 in the NBA look not tall because the median height in the NBA is like 6'6. And then every team's got a 7-footer. Every team in the NBA has at least one 7-footer on the court. This guy was rolling around at 5'3. He figured out a way to be competitive. And then the safety thing. Gotta keep him safe, right? They're going to get hurt. These transgender women are going to hurt these cisgender women. A, show me your work. Show me the empirical data that proves that hypothesis. Don't just say it like it's obviously true. Not Iman Khalif, not that one, because remember, you were wrong about that one. Jake Paul just got his jaw broken in two places and his face inflated like a balloon. But it's cool because they both got dick and balls. When you play professional sports, you are putting your body on the line for your sport. That's just kind of, in most contact sports, in most high energy sports where there's bumping and they're shoving, you're going to like tear your ACL. You're going to have, you know, ankle injuries, broken fingers. You're going to have torn hamstrings. That's just a part of being a competitive athlete at the highest levels. Sports are inherently dangerous. Sports are inherently unfair. When you say, like, obviously it's unfair and it's dangerous, I'm like, A, show me your work, and B, since when was it not? Since when was it ever fair or safe to play professional sports? What the fuck are you talking about? Alex Smith broke his tibia in half playing football, and flesh-eating bacteria started to eat his calf, and then they took fat from his butt and remade a new calf with butt fat, and then he played in the NFL on his leg made out of butt fat. What are we talking about here? Like, if that had happened to him, but a transgender person broke his tibia, then it's bad. Transgender women who compete in sports have to prove that they're, like, not going to be too good if they are allowed to compete. Like, they have to, like, meet certain standards that show that their hormone replacement therapy has been successful to the point of, like, decreasing their speed and decreasing their muscle mass to a point where it's, like, technically okay for them to compete. And no other competitors are held to that standard. Nobody else is, like, well, like, okay, Victor Wembanyama can play basketball, but he's got to prove that he's, like, not that good at shooting. The only way you can be that tall with that kind of a wingspan and play professional basketball is, like, you have to be at least as bad at free throws as Shaq is. And then it's fair. Trans women, in many cases, in order to compete, have to be like, I promise I won't be too good. I promise, like, I will, like, not be too dominant in the sport. And they're like, okay, as long as you promise not to win, we'll allow you to play. Which is also fucked up, because it's like, oh, so the only way I can participate is if I promise not to win? Like, that, like, the only way I can do this is if I'm Leah Thomas and I tie for fifth with Riley Gaines, and even then Riley Gaines will be like, no! I just want to jump in here from editing world and say that this is actually the literal reason why the movie Lady Ballers exists. The Daily Wire wanted to produce a documentary about a bunch of cisgender men pretending to be trans women and competing in women's sports and like dominating, just to illustrate the problem with trans women in women's sports. And what literally happened in real life is all of the sports that they tried to enter into were like, oh, if you actually haven't undergone any kind of process of medical transition, we can't allow you to participate. So the entire premise of their documentary exposing the issue with trans women in women's sports was debunked before they could even get the documentary off the ground. And instead of just like realizing like, oh, I guess we're wrong, I guess like actually there's not really a problem here, they just went and wrote the worst movie ever made, and they made that instead. And Riley Gaines is in that movie because, of course, she is. Anyway, let's actually get to like the point of the show now, right? He goes on to give her grievance score, because he gives out grievance scores. He gives it a C. And I disagree, because he even just goes on to be like, grievance score C, even though she just tied for fifth. So grievance score F. But we are talking about self-defense. He goes on to talk about another professional victim, all of our favorite guy, Kyle Rittenhouse.
Kyle Rittenhouse was a little piglet who took a gun to a BLM riot, got attacked, ran away, and shot his attackers.
I want us all to just focus on that sequence of events that he just laid out right there. Took a gun to a BLM riot, got attacked, shot his attackers, ran away. Showed up with a gun as a vigilante, against the law, not allowed to do that. Gets attacked, shoots the attackers, leaves. That's the sequence of events that he lays out. And then he goes on to say this.
Now, having seen the videos and watched the court case, I do think he should have gotten off. Sure, no matter how much you care for a community, I don't think you should take a weapon to a riot. But it seemed apparent to me, and more importantly, the jury, that he acted in self-defense that night.
Hey man, what the fuck are you talking about? You just said, showed up at a place with a gun, got attacked by some people, shot them, ran away. Having watched the videos, I do think he should have gotten off. First of all, yeah, just again, I'm a fan of this channel. I need to reiterate, I like this channel and I usually like these videos. It's so weird to me though, to hear you, like, just like you did with Riley Gaines, where you're like, I give her grievance a C. Like, she sort of has a grievance, even though she doesn't. Like, you just go on to be like, even though she tied for fifth and nothing actually happened. Even though literally nothing happened to her, I give her grievance a C. It's like, why are you giving her anything? And then here you're like, even though he was the one who was in the wrong place at the wrong time, even though he was the one who showed up with a deadly weapon with the intent to do harm with that deadly weapon, I'm gonna give him a pass and say that he was acting in self-defense. And the jury seems to agree with me too. Even if he's saying like, I'm just here to defend the businesses, the gun says, I'm willing to shoot and kill anyone that like crosses my path who I deem necessary to kill. He is the aggressor in this situation. You laid it out, showed up with a gun, got attacked, shot his attacker, left. That's the sequence of events. Not minding his own business, gets attacked, pulls out his concealed carry, defends his life, and then flees. What about the case where a gunman killed 10 black people in a New York supermarket in Buffalo in 2022? What if that guy said, I was just there to defend the homeland? In fact, we know that, like, that's kind of what was in his head psychologically as a white supremacist. In his brain, he was there to do a service to his country. He was just there to stand up for his values. And in his mind, those people, by virtue of being black, posed a danger to the America that he wanted to live in. And so he showed up somewhere with a gun. And let's say he goes into that store and somebody sees him in that store with a gun and they attack him with a skateboard, the same way that Kyle Rittenhouse was attacked. And he says, well, they attacked me. You showed up first, motherfucker. The soy pill says, according to me, when I watched the video, and according, more importantly, to the jury, it does seem like he met the legal standard for self-defense. So let's just get into the legal mumbo-jumbo, the legal jargon of self-defense. This is from the Legal Information Institute from the Cornell Law School. Self-defense is the use of force to protect oneself from an attempted injury by another. If justified, self-defense is a defense in criminal and tort law. I had to look into what tort law is. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter for the purposes of our video. It's not law about like torts, like tortellini or tarts or anything like that. It doesn't matter. It is used in unlawful acts involving force, such as murder, assault, and battery. For example, in New York penal law, self-defense is justified when someone reasonably believes it is necessary to defend themselves against the use or threatened use of unlawful physical force. The danger must be imminent, meaning that they believed they had to act when they did to avoid the danger. The act of self-defense must be proportionate to the danger, and the person defending themselves cannot be the initial aggressor. That's it right there! The person defending themselves cannot be the initial aggressor. So also, there's two things there in that last sentence, because so far, it's like, if you're listening to that definition, it's like, okay, according to the soy pill, like, I think what Kyle Rittenhouse did seems to meet the standard of the law, that like, if he felt there was an imminent threat to his life, and he felt that these people who were attacking him with the skateboard could potentially kill him with the skateboard somehow, he is legally within his rights to make the case for self-defense. But then we get to that last sentence. The act of self-defense must be proportionate to the danger. Do we actually think that Kyle Rittenhouse was going to get murdered with a skateboard that night, that someone was going to beat him to death with a skateboard? Or do we think the person with the skateboard was just trying to, like, use whatever weapon they could find to fend off the armed shooter who was in the area, the kid who showed up in the area, the gunman who showed up in the area, who was clearly not a law enforcement officer, who was clearly not with the police, just a rando conservative chud who showed up with a gun to kill people? Do we think that, like, the intent of that person was like, I'm gonna murder him back with this skateboard? Or do we think that person was just like, hopefully I can knock him out or knock him down long enough to, like, save other people from this guy who fucking showed up with a gun? None of us have guns. Why the fuck does he have a gun? So proportionate to the danger, that's the first thing. And the second one is, the person defending themselves cannot be the initial aggressor. This is often cited in a case called United States versus Peterson, which is used to teach law students the self-defense doctrine. In this case, United States versus Peterson, the defendant used a gun to threaten a man trying to steal his windshield wipers. Kind of similar to what Rittenhouse is doing. I'm going to show up somewhere and I'm going to threaten people who are breaking windows and doing vandalism, doing property damage. I'm going to threaten them with the gun. This guy threatens a man with a gun who's stealing his windshield wipers from his car. When the man who was stealing the windshield wipers threatened the guy with the gun with a wrench, so guy at the protest wields a skateboard as a weapon, threatens the defendant with a wrench, the defendant shot and killed him. The use of the self-defense doctrine failed here due to the defendant's status as the initial aggressor. The defendant was the first to threaten physical force when he threatened the man with a gun. Kyle Rittenhouse introduced deadly force into that entire situation by being the one who showed up with a gun, going, I'm here to kill people. I'm here to end lives. And there's no way that they don't know that that's why he's there. There's no way that they know, like, he's just going, hey, I'm not going to shoot anybody. I'm just here just in case. I got my gun just in case. I'm not. Why the fuck are you rolling up with a gun, kid? Why are you threatening people who are not doing anything lethal, who are breaking windows, with lethal force? You are the initial aggressor in that situation. Not only is the soy pill wrong that what Kyle Rittenhouse did meets the legal standard of self-defense, he had no legal right to be there. What he was doing was illegal. We're not talking about, like, a police shooting here, and we will get to the police shootings. We will be talking about Renee Nicole Good later on the show. We will be talking about a handful of police shootings, but we're not even talking about that. We're talking about a kid taking vigilante justice into his own hands, crossing state lines to show up and threaten random people with a gun. Those people have the right to defend themselves against this gunman. At that point, Kyle Rittenhouse, in that situation, is just your ordinary Christian conservative white radical gunman. And we've got a lot of those in this country. And anybody who sees someone like that walking around with a gun, aiming it at people, taking shots, has the right to go up and fucking hit that person in the face with a skateboard. But I get that, you know, what he's trying to say is like, Kyle Rittenhouse shouldn't be on a speaking tour. Kyle Rittenhouse shouldn't be a hero to the right. He shouldn't be getting millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars in speaking bonuses and getting on all these podcasts and being on Fox News just because he killed some people. That's the soy pills point in his video. And again, I like the video for the most part. It's just that this thing made me go like, huh, we've given so many people the idea that they can just manufacture a situation where they can claim self-defense if they want to kill somebody that they are ideologically opposed to. And that's sort of the Rittenhouse thing to me, is just like, I'm going to show up in a situation where I'm clearly the aggressor. I'm clearly making people fear for their lives, and I'm going to wait for one of them to reasonably pose a threat to me so that I can justify acting out this fantasy that I have of getting to kill them. Now, we've all seen the footage of like Kyle Rittenhouse like throwing up at the police station and crying his eyes out and freaking out and having a panic attack and crying on the stand, because he wasn't psychologically prepared for the toll of what he wanted to do. But he went out there that night thinking he was tough, thinking he could handle it. He had a fantasy of like, I'm going to go out there and I hope one of them tries me. I hope one of those protesters, one of those BLM thugs, one of those Antifa radicals, I hope they try me and I'm ready. He knew the law well enough. He'd seen enough cops get off by saying, I feared for my life, that he knew he could manufacture the consent of the ruling powers. But we've really created a house of cards here. We've really created a messy situation for ourselves with the way that we apply self-defense in this kind of haphazard way. It results in situations like you see in this documentary, The Perfect Neighbor, that was on Netflix. Fantastic documentary, by the way. Really original way to shoot something. It's all shot with body cam footage, the entire thing. And it documents basically the killing of Ajike A.J. Chantrell Owens by her 58-year-old white neighbor, Susan Louise Lawrence. And this is, it's this process that happens over like several months, where Susan Louise Lawrence is just this racist, angry, shitty white lady who lives in a neighborhood with a lot of black families, and she's constantly calling the cops on their kids for doing things that their kids are allowed to do, like just making noise while they're playing, or playing too close to her property line. Not on her property, but just like closer to her property line than she wants them. Roller skating on the grass next to her grass, and she feels like them roller skating is like messing up the grass. Susan Louise Lawrence used the police officers as her own personal attack dogs, the way that a lot of entitled white women think the police operate, that it's just sort of like, hey, if I call you and I tell you to arrest somebody, you do it. And, you know, thank God the police in the documentary, for the most part, like when they show up every time with her issue, they're just like, ma'am, you got to stop calling us for this bullshit. Like, this is nothing. You're wasting our time. You're wasting the state resources when you call us for this stuff. Like, please stop calling us for this. It would be great if they would like maybe threaten some action toward her of being like, if you do this again and we come back, like there's going to be consequences for you. But basically what happens is like after calling the cops like 5 or 6 times on her neighbors for doing things that they are legally allowed to do, she decides to take matters into her own hands and manufacture a scenario where she can claim self-defense to murder her neighbor. And basically what she does is she like throws some stuff at her neighbor's kids. You know, she is the initial aggressor. She starts a fight with these kids, and their mom comes over to her house to be like, you don't fucking throw stuff at my kids. We have a problem now. Like, it's one thing when you keep calling the cops on us. It's another when you take roller skates and throw them at my kid's head. Like, I'm gonna push your head through the wall now. Her door's locked, and AJ is banging on the door saying, you better come out here and fucking talk to me, because we got a problem. And Susan Louise Lawrence takes this as an opportunity to go, I think I feel sufficiently threatened to shoot through the door and end my neighbor's life. And that's what she does. She kills her neighbor. And luckily, the courts found her guilty of manslaughter. Basically, what they said was she couldn't use the Florida's stand your ground rules, which have been used in all kinds of shootings, like the Trayvon Martin shooting. But they said she couldn't use stand your ground because she was behind a locked door. Maybe if the door had been kicked in and the lock had been broken, maybe then she's allowed to start shooting. Maybe if the door is broken in and she sees that AJ is carrying a weapon, like a knife or something, maybe then. But also, like, couple things here. She's the initial aggressor, not just that night, not just when she threw the roller skates at AJ's kids, but the whole time. Like, she's been egging on this family for months and months and months, and the cops have been not doing what she wants them to do. So she's just like, well, I've seen enough on the internet and seen enough on TV to, like, know that as a white woman, I can probably get away with shooting my neighbor and just saying I feared for my life. She thought it would work for her. And thank God the system at least found her guilty of manslaughter. Should have been more, but at least she was found guilty of something, and she wasn't just let off the hook. But this is what I'm talking about, is like, we've set this precedent in this country, especially for white people who feel empowered to just kind of manufacture consent from the state to kill people. And it happens because we witness so much state-sanctioned violence. We've witnessed so much since the era of Rodney King, like, since people started filming police officers murdering people on the street, we've watched such an alarming amount of people be murdered by police officers, and all they have to say are those magic words, "I was afraid for my life." Those were the words that got the police officers off in the Rodney King case. What was it, 10, 11, or 12 officers that were surrounding one guy? And if you watch the video, it's just a gang beating of one man who has no ability to fight back. He's just getting the shit kicked out of him. And they all said, "We feared for our lives." And it couldn't be clearer in the video that there's just no possible way that's true. But that was the thing that made those the magic words, that was like, oh, you can kill people, especially people of color, if you're wearing a badge and you've got some kind of official uniform on, and you say, "I was afraid for my life." Some of the most egregious, or one of the most egregious examples of this to me in recent history, is the murder of Philando Castile. There's this great podcast called 74 Seconds, and it's called 74 Seconds because that's the amount of time that lapsed between Geronimo Yanez leaving his car and Geronimo Yanez murdering Philando Castile. 74 seconds, 14 seconds longer than a minute. And the problem with the whole Philando Castile killing is, like, anyone can go watch this video. You can go listen to the podcast. I highly recommend it. But it's just like, it's just such a mind-bogglingly short amount of time. And B, Philando Castile did everything right. He does everything right in their interaction. There is nothing about his behavior that is even remotely threatening. The only thing in that case is that Geronimo Yanez had been told that he had been given a description of a suspect in a robbery, and he thought Philando Castile looked somewhat like the description he had been given. So he pulled him over thinking this might be the guy who robbed the liquor store or whatever it was last night. And that put the idea in his head, I might be in danger here. And you can watch in the video, he's got his hand on his firearm from the jump. As he's walking up, guns unbuckled, and he's ready to go from the jump. And it's just this thing where it's like, at no point was Geronimo Yanez approaching that situation thinking, like, I can just talk to this guy, like, a relatively calm interaction, and just kind of go, hey, you know, just doing a check here, you know, like, but, like, from the jump, what happens is he walks up to the window. Philando Castile says, "Hey, I just want to let you know I've got a firearm in the car. I've got a concealed carry permit." And immediately Geronimo Yanez is freaking the fuck out. Like, his temperament he just goes like, don't grab it. Don't grab it. And he goes, "I'm not going to." And he's like, don't grab it. And he's like, why would I tell you I have a gun in the car that's concealed and I have a concealed carry permit if my plan is to surprise you by pulling it out and shooting you? Why would I tell you that?" And he goes, "No, I don't. I'm going to get the permit for you." He reaches, and that's the end of his life. Murdered in front of his girlfriend and in front of his daughter. You would think, if ever there was a slam dunk case for, like, you can't claim self-defense on this one, you just can't, it's got to be this one. And no, he said the magic words, "I feared for my life," and they let him off. no consequences, because of course they did. And so when you live in that world where people are conditioned that it's like, oh, that's all I got to do. All I got to do is just say the magic words and I'm off scot-free. It just sort of makes the whole concept of self-defense something that it's like, maybe we need to revisit this we need to have like clearer language around this or clearer standards. And certainly we need to have better standards for law enforcement, because when it comes to civilians, it kind of seems like a toss up. It's just sort of like, well, maybe we'll honor it and maybe we won't. It kind of seems like, if you kill a person of color, you're way more likely as a white person to get off if you say, I feared for my life. Or if you were acting in some kind of vigilante capacity, like a volunteer officer of the law, the same, you know, the way that George Zimmerman was when he killed Trayvon Martin, or the way that Kyle Rittenhouse was when he went to those riots that he had no business being at. If you're acting like a cop, people are like, all right, that's cool. Even though you're not supposed to do that, the law seems to be like, yeah, hey, bones, we dig that. Like that's kind of our thing that rocks. But if you're sort of like an annoying old lady like Susan Lawrence, who's just like in her house trying to pick a fight, the law's like, I don't know. We want to give this one to you, but you're kind of like, you've just sort of been bothering us for months and months and months. If that had been the first time that the police had been called to that neighborhood to deal with like an issue, when she shot AJ, I think there's a really good chance she would have been let off. But because they were already kind of annoyed at her, they were like, eh, you know what? I don't know. The only time I can think of in recent memory that someone was actually convicted was Derek Chauvin. And I think the only difference there is that Derek Chauvin could not in any world claim self-defense. There was no, the only option that Derek Chauvin's legal team had was to try to say, well, it wasn't the choking him for 10 minutes on camera that killed him. It was the fentanyl that he had in his system. That's why he died. It was because of the fentanyl. It wasn't because he got choked to death on camera for 10 minutes. It's because he had done a little bit of fentanyl earlier in the day. And that was just not as strong of a defense as I feared for my life. And obviously Derek Chauvin couldn't say I was afraid for my life, because everyone can watch the tape and go like, no, like it just doesn't work. So they weren't able to say the magic words. You would think that Geronimo Yanez wouldn't be able to say the magic words watching the tape. It's just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Philando Castile was just like, hey, just letting you know, don't freak out. Please don't shoot me. I do have a gun in the car. Please don't freak out. And he's like, well, all right, let's do it. But Derek Chauvin, like, it feels like the state, at the state level, they were like, bud, we really want to give this one to you, but we just can't. If you can't say the magic words. And that brings us all the way back to Renee. Okay, we're back to Renee Nicole Good. The big thing for conservatives and the federal government, the big justification, the big question in play is, was she trying to murder him with her car? Was she trying to use her vehicle as a weapon to kill him? When you listen to the official narrative, obviously, from the federal government, it's of course. She's a domestic terrorist who is there for the express purpose of running over ICE agents with her car. And, you know, they had no other choice but to act in self-defense. But that's the big question. And, you know, the stance from conservative commentators and just conservative chuds in general and the federal government is, if she was indeed using her car as a weapon, then the agent is authorized to do anything and everything he wants with zero consequences. We're going to jump into this response that I got from a guy named Ballistic Bob, great screen name, who responded to one of my videos. And I just have to warn you, his voice is absolutely insufferable, but he, you know, he kind of thought he would learn me up and school me on what the law says about this. Don't shoot people in the face who are just trying to get away from you and your masked gang when they accidentally drive up on you and your masked gang.
A home surveillance camera captures the moment Renee Good pulls up in a maroon-colored Honda SUV 4 minutes before the shooting.
Okay, so the first thing here is I made that video the day it happened, and we didn't have all the information yet. We didn't know everything about, like, the entire timeline of the crime. He's using the fact that I said, like, if a person just rolls onto a residential street and a bunch of masked guys with guns run up to their car, that person should be legally allowed to, like, do a three-point turn and get out of there without being murdered. And what he's pointing out here is, like, they were there to be agitators and to impede what ICE was doing. He's basically just using the fact that, like, there's a semantic detail that I got wrong in the first video that I made about it to say, like, oh, well, you're lying and spreading propaganda. But again, like, everything about the state's narrative, everything about the federal government's narrative that, like, they were there to kill ICE agents with their car, that Renee Good was there to use her car as a weapon to kill ICE agents. Why didn't she just, like when a person shows up to something to ram people with their car and kill them, they don't, like, roll up and park and hang out. That's not the move. Whenever we see people who are actually using their cars to drive through protesters and kill them, first of all, it's always conservatives. It's always people on the right who do that. That's a very conservative, chud, proud boy, coward, dipshit move. But they're always the ones that are driving through cars and killing crowds and killing people with their cars. But you don't, like, drive up and then, like, hang out and, like, talk to the protesters for a while in your car and then go, like, now I'm gonna kill one of you. Like, now I'm gonna run one of you. Now that me and my wife have, like, sat here and, like, chatted with you guys and, like, had a little standoff, now I'm gonna run one of you over. Like, you're gonna have to prove that, like, she went there with the intent to use her car as a vehicle, like, as a weapon to kill ICE agents and not just to be a constitutional observer, which is something she and her wife had been doing for a while. Now, constitutional observers are people who show up to observe ICE while they are in the midst of, like, their operations, just to make sure that, like, they're doing everything on the up and up. If ICE is doing something illegal, they want to be there to film it and make sure that the world sees it because they know that the news is not going to report on it. They have a constitutional right to be there in the vicinity and to film. No one is being obstructed. First of all, there is no operation taking place that is being impeded. This is another thing, is people go, like, she was obstructing. Obstructing federal officers. No, she wasn't. The whole timeline, all the videos from every single angle show that, like, no one's being obstructed. There's no operation happening that is being stopped. Renee Good and her wife are not, like, impeding the officers from going into a building or even driving up and down the street. We see clearly moments before she's murdered that she's waving ICE officers by. She's telling them to pass as she's in that little maneuver about to, like, turn her wheel all the way to the right and leave the scene. She's waving them past. In order to obstruct an official operation, they have to be in the middle of an operation, like arresting someone. So if they were in the middle of an arrest and Renee Good and her wife were obstructing their ability to do that, that's obstruction. By the way, the penalty for obstruction is not being shot in the face three times. The reason why there are so many videos of ICE agents on the internet right now doing all kinds of illegal shit and body slamming people and shooting into people's cars. By the way, Renee Good was not the first car that ICE agents have shot into. They've been shooting into cars for a while now, and this is a big problem. But the reason why they were there is because of that. Because of all of this illegal criminal behavior that ICE agents do, they were there to observe, as is their constitutional right. Not to obstruct, not to impede, but he wants to come in here and be pedantic and be like, because I said a person pulls onto a residential street, sees a bunch of masked thugs, and tries to get out of there, he's like, actually, she showed up, and she was there for several minutes. It's before they killed her. So what now? It's like, well, what now is she still doesn't deserve to be shot in the face. What now is she wasn't obstructing. She wasn't doing anything illegal. She has a legal right to be there. What now is she's a constitutional observer. There are always constitutional observers present at ICE operations. They're not getting shot in the face. But he goes on to say this.
I didn't realize that people who were just trying to get away, your words, not mine, would pull in, drop off their significant other, then proceed to pull across the roadway in an attempt to interfere with or impede federal law enforcement. Do you comprehend 18 U.S.C. 111? Clearly you don't.
I tried to warn you about his voice and his face and his general aura. It's really bad. It's really bad.
Do you comprehend 18 U.S.C. 111? Clearly you don't. Accidental, as you say. Oh, God, my God. Just what an unlikable
chud of a man. What a fucking, like, booger. What a fucking, like, tonsil stone of a human being. Blah! He says, do you understand 18 U.S. Code 111? Clearly you do not. So let's actually go back to the Legal Information Institute from the Cornell Law School, and let's read what 18 U.S. Code 111 is. The title is Assaulting, Resisting, or Impeding Certain Officers or Employees. Okay, in general, whoever, one, forcibly assaults, resists, opposes, impedes, intimidates, or interferes with any person designated in Section 1114 of this title while engaged in or on account of the performance of official duties, or two, forcibly assaults or intimidates any person who formerly served as a person designated in Section 1114 on account of the performance of official duties during such person's term of service, shall, where the acts in violation of this section constitute only simple assault, be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. And where such acts involve physical contact with the victim of that assault or the intent to commit another felony, be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 8 years or both. A fine or imprisonment of either 1 year or potentially 8 years if it warrants it, if there's physical contact and injury. Neither one of those is shot in the face three times. I hope you're noting. I hope everybody's paying attention. But you know what? There's a section for enhanced penalty. This is probably where the shot in the face three times at point blank comes into play. This is probably what Vice President J.D. Vance is referencing when he talks about absolute immunity. Let's keep reading. Whoever in the commission of any acts described in subsection A uses a deadly or dangerous weapon, including a weapon intended to cause death or danger, but that fails to do so by reason of a defective component. Okay, now we're getting to it. Or inflicts bodily injury, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. Okay, still doesn't say shot in the face three times, but he was so convinced that he understood 18 U.S. Code 111 and that I didn't. He must be certain that what 18 U.S. Code 111 says is that if you do these things, they have the legal right to shoot you in the face. I think, you know what? There must be something about, like, where in, like, the ICE, like, training manual or something that talks about this, where, like, if a person tries to hit you with their car, you can shoot them. I know that I've read about a law like that, that there's a law that says, like, if a car is going to hit you, you have the right to, you know, react in self-defense. There was this interview that was done with Seth Stotten, who was a former Florida police officer who is now a professor of law and criminal justice at the University of South Carolina. This is like a Southern good old boy we're talking to here, who says the highest priority, this was in Mother Jones, this interview, and he said the highest priority in policing is preserving the sanctity of human life. That obviously includes officers' lives, but it's also community members' lives, and that includes criminal suspects. When officers put themselves into harm's way, they often do so in a professionally appropriate way because doing so is necessary to help preserve the lives of community members. Think of an active shooter situation, you know, like Uvalde or something like that, where officers would put themselves in harm's way to protect community members' lives, or they would just sit around for several hours because they're a bunch of cowards who are completely useless. In other circumstances, it's not professionally appropriate for officers to rush in and put themselves in harm's way because there is a safer and more effective way of getting the mission done. If an officer is not threatened by a vehicle, then they don't have to shoot the driver of that vehicle. Good tactics are not just about preserving officer safety. Good tactics are about preserving everyone's safety. So again, going back, like, There is nothing happening in the video of Renee Nicole Good that suggests that the officers are feeling like Renee is about to drive her car into them or is threatening them with her car. From the moment she shows up to the moment she leaves, at no point is she looking at him going, "You guys better back up or I'm going to drive this car right through you. You better put your guns down." You know how we know this? Nobody else in the situation is responding the way that the shooter is. Nobody else feels like nobody's pulling their weapon out. At no point in this situation is there any reason for him to get in front of her car. She's not threatening anybody with her car. When they released his fucking cell phone video, when they were like, "This is the smoking gun," when J.D. Vance, when the vice president of the United States was like, "Ha, this is it," and all the conservative chuds were like, "Proven not guilty by self-defense." It was so fucking insane because all we saw in that video was her being like, "Hey man, why are you so upset? I'm not mad at you." Smiling at him and being like, "Buddy, I don't have any beef with you. Why are you getting so mad?" And then he puts himself in front of the car. They were not aiming their car at him. He like runs to get in front of the car to manufacture consent. This is Kyle Rittenhouse manufacturing a scenario where he gets to play out a fantasy. This is Susan Lawrence manufacturing a scenario. "I'm going to throw the skates at my neighbor's kid so I can antagonize her to come over to my house and bang on my locked door so I can shoot her." He is manufacturing the danger in this scenario. In this interview with Seth Stotten, he goes on to say, this is a 2000 article in Police called "Stay Out of the Way." It's talking about vehicle shootings involving police officers between 2001 and 2006. There have been more than 17 officers injured and at least two officers killed as a result of incidents involving motor vehicles being used as weapons by suspects. Many of these incidents were the result of poor police tactics and training. For example, many of the officers involved in these incidents positioned themselves in the path of a motor vehicle in the early stages of an incident, apparently in an attempt to control the suspect or prevent the suspect from leaving the scene. If you take nothing else away from this article, then remember this: your flesh, bone, and muscle are no match against the mass and momentum of a car or truck. That's from an article that is like sent to police officers everywhere that they all read about, that's like, don't get in front of a car to try to control the situation. Especially, I really think this is really interesting right here. This sentence right here: to control the suspect or prevent the suspect from leaving. Why would he be preventing Nicole Good and her wife from Renee Nicole Good and her wife from leaving the scene? They don't want them there, right? All they were there to do is just be constitutional observers, and they don't like that. ICE doesn't like being looked at. They don't like being filmed and observed while they commit their crimes. They want them to leave, ostensibly, right? Like, the goal is to get them to leave. So why stand in front of the car to prevent her from leaving? What are you keeping them there to do? There's a really, really great video from Sujia that I think, where I think she found something really, really smart about, and like kind of brilliant, that if I were the lawyer arguing against the officer in this situation, I would use this from his cell phone footage. We're going to watch this together.
Then Jonathan Ross goes to the back of the car where he encounters Renee's wife. There's something in this part of the footage that I think is important to note. See here, you can see in the reflection of the car, his phone is in his right hand. Then as he's filling the license plate, he encounters Renee's wife. And big, strong Jonathan does not like what she has to say.
"That's fine. U.S. citizen, you wanna come at us? I say go get yourself some lunch, big boy."
Did you catch that? While they're having their exchange, he walks further around the car, and then he does this. He switches. He switches the phone from his right hand to his left hand. Because what side of his body is his firearm on? See? He was ready. He switched his phone from his right hand to his left hand so his right hand could be ready.
Huge. Huge! He switches the phone from his right hand to his left hand. Why? Phone's in his right hand. Wife gets out and talks to him in a way he doesn't like. He's not in front of the car right now, by the way. Nobody's in front of the car. The car is not being pointed at anyone. The car is not being threatened to be used as a weapon. But after this interaction, in the middle of this interaction, he decides, fuck these people. I've had enough. I don't like being talked to like this. And he switches to his left hand. Why? Because his weapon is on his right hip. And he's getting ready to do what he's going to do. And he knows how to do it. You know why he knows how to do it? Because it turns out he's the motherfucker in charge of training other ICE officers about these kinds of situations. He knows when it is justified and when it is not, because he's the guy who actually does the fucking training. He's not like some new recruit who didn't know what he was doing and was like not trained well enough. He's the trainer. So he knows exactly what he needs to do to manufacture consent. He's already made the plan when he switches the camera from his right hand to his left hand and he starts to put his hand on his weapon. Now all he has to do is move in front of the car, put himself in danger. He was not put in danger. He puts himself in danger so he can manufacture the consent of the state. So he can say, I feared for my life, so he can have the magic words.
He switched his phone from his right hand to his left hand so his right hand could be ready. This was before the car was moving, because Renee only started driving forward once this guy started pulling on her door trying to open it. But Jonathan Ross already had his gun unholstered.
That's so huge, too. The gun is coming out before the car moves forward, well before the car moves forward. The thing that is the impetus for the car moving forward is when the officer on the driver's side starts trying to open the door. He starts trying to detain Renee and her wife. As soon as that happens, they both know, as constitutional observers, as people who do this, or as the federal government would call them, like professional agitators or domestic terrorists, they know, like, nothing good happens when you let the ICE agents illegally detain you and take you to the second location. As soon as this motherfucker is illegally trying to open their door and detain him, something he does not have the legal right to do, they're like, oh, we got to get the fuck out of here. Because they know the drill. They know, like, we cannot actually afford to allow him to open our door and zip tie us and take us to a second location. We might not survive the second location. That's the impetus for them to drive away. But the gun's already out. The gun is out before the car is moving, and that's because he's already decided he's gonna use the gun before he even moves in front of the car. He's already made the decision. There's a reason why nobody else has their guns out, and he does, because he's already decided what the position he needs to be in to technically justify shooting and what he already wants to do. He's already ready to do it, and that's why we get the fucking bitch afterward. But also, you know, there's this detail that you've all very cleverly pointed out.
Hi, you cannot shoot somebody again if they are not an immediate threat to you. Like, if someone comes charging at you with a knife and they're trying to stab you, you're allowed to shoot them in the leg. But if after you shoot them, you know, they hit the ground and the knife flies out of their hand and they're now incapacitated on the floor, you're not allowed to walk up to them and shoot them again. At that point, that would actually be, fun fact, murder, because they are not posing any immediate danger to you and you have the full ability to just leave the room. I say this because the second two shots that man took were from the side of the vehicle, through the driver's side window, the point at which he's already fully out of the way of the car, so he cannot claim self-defense for either of those two shots.
Also, you know, just the first shot was from an angle. Wasn't straight on. He was already at, like, the corner of the car. There's so many conservatives that are, like, mulling over the details of, like, the furthest away angle and being like, does his hip get bumped here? They're trying so hard to justify it because they know deep down it's entirely unjustifiable.
And you can see right here, if the cop wasn't in front of the vehicle, then he wouldn't have been able to make this shot. There it is. It's pretty fucking obvious.
They know it's cold-blooded murder, but they're, like, combing over every angle and being like, does his hip get grazed here? And here's the thing is, I don't fucking care. He put himself there. And he starts shooting when he's already clear of the path of the vehicle to do any harm to him. If it does bump his hip, I don't know if it does or not. I don't think it does. But even if it does, A, he put himself there on purpose so that he could manufacture consent. And B, he starts shooting once he's already out of the path of the vehicle being able to do any harm to him. That's what we clearly see from every single aspect of this video. From the behavior, from the beginning to the end of this interaction, to where he says, fucking bitch, we know what happened there. Cold-blooded murder, Motherfucker should be in prison for the rest of his life.
One last thing I gotta jump on here and say before I get into the talk back with the TikTok Digital Studio audience. This is something I left out of my outline when I initially recorded this episode, and it's kind of a really big part of this conversation because ultimately this episode is about the difference between how the state wields the concept of self-defense as a pretext or justification for violence and how ordinary people like you and me wield the concept of self-defense as a pretext for some form of necessary violence. And obviously there are massive differences there, right? Like when someone like you or me wants to use the concept of self-defense as a justification for violence, as a pretext for violence, it usually needs to fit that original definition that we looked at where it talks about the response being proportional, you know, that like whatever a person is doing to you, it needs to be proportional. You've all talked about how if you're able to incapacitate someone, if you shoot them in the leg and they fall over and they drop the knife that they're threatening you with, you need to stop. Unless they get back up. If they get back up and they pick the knife back up, you can keep going. But once they are incapacitated and you have neutralized the threat, you need to stop. Whereas the state is can play a lot more fast and loose with those rules. The big thing that I can't believe I left off here is like when we witness police brutality, when we witness events where officers of the law with a badge and a uniform kill citizens in the street, on camera, whatever, in front of community members, this is the micro version of how states wield the concept of self-defense as a pretext for violence. The macro version of how nation states use this concept of self-defense as a pretext or justification for violence or even ultra-violence is what we see every time one of these big nation states goes to war. The United States is fantastic at this. We were attacked in 2001 by Al-Qaeda terrorists. America is allowed to defend itself. We were a nation under siege. Our people were in danger. This is the pretext. This is the justification for we are now justified in putting boots on the ground in another sovereign nation, invading a few different sovereign nations, and doing kind of whatever we feel we need to do next to get even. But that's the big difference, right, between the way the state views defense, self-defense, and the way we view self-defense, because self-defense to us is just you have the right to extricate yourself from immediate danger. Whatever, if you find yourself in an immediate threat situation, you have the right to neutralize the threat if you are able, or to do everything you can to get out of that situation, unless the threat is an agent of the state. If an agent of the state is threatening you, we don't even have the right in that situation to run away. How many situations have you seen where a cop shot someone in the back as they were fleeing? Where someone was murdered by police officers while they were just trying to get away from them? Obviously not posing a threat to those police officers' safety because they're heading in the opposite direction. They're running away. We're not even allowed to try to run away. We're not even allowed to just try to flee to safety when we're dealing with agents of the state. Our definition of self-defense as the proletariat, as the populace, is you can either neutralize a threat or do whatever you can to get away from that threat. But the way that the state sees this, they're emboldened and empowered by our current structure to not just defend their own lives or the lives of the people who they are charged to protect, whatever. They feel emboldened and empowered to do whatever they want to do to get ultra vengeance, to enact like some kind of unquenchable bloodlust for vengeance. How many times have you heard a politician say in America, Israel has the right to defend itself? It's one of the most, I mean, it's become one of the most common slogans in the Democratic and Republican Party that of the last 40 or 50 years. Israel has the right to defend itself. What does that mean in the context of how self-defense is applied to a nation state? Okay, there is an attack on October 7th of 2023. 1,200 Israeli citizens or thereabout are killed. Horrific situation, you know? Terrible when something like that happens. what does self-defense look like? If it's between the populace, if it's between the proletariat, I guess self-defense would be like if you happen to be in that situation and there's someone who you're at the music festival or whatever, and there is someone, you know, from Hamas who's coming and they're going to kill you, you have the right to fight them off and if necessary to kill them to protect your own life. But from the perspective of the state, what it clearly looks like is there is no limit to what we can do next. So what I mean is when we see this on a micro level with agents of the state like police officers and border patrol officers, where they're allowed to shoot someone, kill someone, you know, mace someone, throw someone on the ground for like really minor offenses. And all they have to do is say, well, that person was threatening my safety. And they're allowed to escalate the violence to a really unreasonable degree without consequences. But it only goes up, it scales up so much when you take it to the level of state militaries. Because if Jonathan Ross, who shot Renee Nicole Good, had actually behaved like a nation state in this situation, it would have been more like Renee Nicole Good bumped me with her car, a situation I put myself in. Now try to imagine Israel. Hamas bumped me in the hip with their car, even though I put myself in the situation where, like, I was like, come on, hit me with the car. I egged them on for decades. I you know, did everything I could to antagonize them to hit me with their car. And as soon as that bumper touched my hip, I told all of the agents around me, let's kill everybody in this neighborhood. That's the like response from the Israeli government is, well, they bumped my hip. You saw it. October 7th, we got a pretty nasty hip bump. And the response isn't just, I'm going to shoot this woman driving the car three times in the face. The response is, I'm going to kill everyone even remotely associated with this woman. I'm going to kill all of her known associates. I'm going to kill everyone she went to school with growing up. I'm going to decimate her entire family. I'm going to decimate the neighborhood that she's from, the neighboring neighborhoods. I won't stop. You won't be able to stop me. And I will just keep saying it's all self-defense. I'm allowed to defend myself. That's ultimately that I can't believe I left that out of my outline, because I think that's a massively important thing to drive home here at the end of this conversation, is the way that the state weaponizes this concept and the way that they pervert this concept and contort this concept into a pretext to justify all manner of insane ultra-violence that's way over the top, way disproportionate. There doesn't seem to be any end to it. Like, it just seems like once a government, like the United States government or the Israeli government, declares that they are under attack, declares that they feel unsafe, they use that as a pretext to do anything and everything for as long as they want to whoever has made them feel unsafe. No matter how small the initial offense was in comparison, in relation to the response is always justified under the umbrella pretext of self-defense. We as a nation have the right to defend ourselves. We as a police force have the right to defend ourselves. We as citizens sort of have the right to defend ourselves, unless we're dealing with agents of the state. And then we have the right to die. So from a legal, strictly legal standpoint, do I think that the shooting of Renee Nicole Good has a good like legal standing for self-defense? Absolutely not. I think it's weak as fuck. I think it's very clear that the officer who did the shooting put himself in that situation unnecessarily, that goes against every standard of training, that he should know that training because he's the one in charge of doing it. I think it's clear from his cell phone footage, the moment when he decides to shoot Renee Nicole Good and how he decides to manufacture consent for that, how he knows he's going to get Kristi Noem and J.D. Vance and the president all signing off on it, moves the cell phone to his left hand, unholsters his weapon, does it before she's even begun moving forward, sidesteps the car and starts shooting from an angle from shot one. I think it's an incredibly weak case. But here's what I actually want to talk about in this episode. Like, the actual thing I want to get down to is sort of like legality versus morality and the ethics of it. Because honestly, even if it had hypothetically met the legal standard for self-defense, it doesn't. But even if it had, even if all of these conservative chuds online were like technically correct that he has the right to claim self-defense, I think we need to be having a much more important philosophical
spiritual conversation as a society and as a culture about just like, how do you actually feel when you see the letter of the law of self-defense being applied in the real world? Like, get away from like what you think, whether you think that the letter of the law is being followed. In this case, I really don't think that it is. I think that all of the evidence shows that it's not. But let's set that aside and just get to like, do you think Renee Nicole Good should be alive right now? How do you feel about a mother being shot in the face at point blank range 3 times in front of her spouse, in front of her community? The fact that her kids are orphaned now because of that. So many of these conservative people are online twisting themselves into pretzels to try to be like, well, you know, that's what happens. That's what happens when you try to run over an officer, and that's technically he's allowed to kill her. Even if you were correct, and you're not, but even if you were, is that right? Is that right? Does that feel good to you that like a person is able to easily sidestep some like a threat? Someone's threatening someone with their car, but they miss. They miss and they like graze your hip. At that point, you're just like, whatever happens to that person next, I sign off on it 100%. I just feel like we're missing this like core moral philosophy around this. It's the Spider-Man philosophy of like, with great power comes great responsibility. There are these roles in society that are essential. They're some of like the cornerstones of any functioning society. We need doctors. We need good medicine, good reliable medicine. And people who are going to be doctors have to have extensive training. We need good teachers. We need good education. And people who are going to hold that title have a lot, like really stringent qualifications that they need to meet in order to be a teacher. And we do need, to some degree or another, law enforcement. We need a place we can go when, like, someone's been, when we're like, this person fucked up and did a really bad thing to me, and we need to hold them accountable as a culture and as a society. We need some kind of system for that. I think our entire system that we have in this country is deeply, deeply, deeply flawed. But it really starts at just, like, anyone can be a fucking cop. The requirements to get that badge and that uniform are so piss poor. And then when it comes to being an ICE agent, they're even worse. And we endow these people with such an insane amount of power. We don't give teachers and doctors that much power, at least not without consequences. They at least have the responsibility of being like, hey, we're going to give you a big amount of power, but if you misuse that power, we're going to take it away immediately. That teacher at the University of Oklahoma who accurately graded that shitty essay got fired from her job for giving that student an F. And doctors can be sued for malpractice if they're not sticking to a certain standard. But it is so hard for law enforcement officers to ever see any kinds of consequences when they fuck up. And they fuck up so often. We give them so much power. We give them the power to commit state-sanctioned murder if it is necessary. And then we just kind of say, hey, as long as you say the magic words, I feared for my life, have at it. And we will never, ever look any deeper into it than that. We will always have your back, and we will almost never hold you accountable for that. And that is such a deep moral and ethical failing on our part as a society, that like, if we are going to endow people with that kind of power, if we are going to endow them with those kinds of extrajudicial powers that we say like, hey, in certain situations, you're allowed to be judge, jury, and executioner, we have to be so stringent about how that's applied. Way more often, cops should be going to jail for murder. Like, it should be known amongst law enforcement that like, hey, if you are going to take your gun out of its holster, you had better know that you have the legal recourse to do so. And if you are going to fire it, you had better be goddamn sure that there's a good reason why you're firing it. Because if you're not, we are going to get you. We are going to make sure that not only do you lose your job, but that you go to jail for that, because you can only commit state-sanctioned murder if it meets these very strict qualifications. So, and it's like the fact that like, we're doing it in the complete reverse, that it's just sort of like, hey, as long as you say I was afraid for my life, even if we can clearly see on camera that you're manufacturing the situation that's making you technically, quote unquote, afraid for your life, even if we can see on camera that the person who was making you feel afraid was doing nothing to threaten you, you know, Philando Castile or just so many countless other situations, even if we've got the whole thing on camera, as long as you say the magic words, you're off scot-free. And that's the conversation I want to have about self-defense. I don't really fucking care if it meets the legal definition or not. I want us to think about, as a society, like, is this being applied in a way that makes sense? I don't really care if you watch the video of Renee Nicole Good and you think she shouldn't have been there, she shouldn't have been antagonizing him, and she shouldn't have driven her car at him, even though the video clearly shows that she turns her wheel all the way to the right and that she's driving away because one guy is trying to open her door and illegally detain her, even though that's what it shows. I don't really give a fuck what your shitty armchair opinion is. I'm looking at your soul and going like, do you feel good about what happened? And you can say, well, maybe I don't feel good about it, but like, hey, they had legal recourse and I think you're wrong. But like, I think we need to be talking about what is your emotional response to that? What is your human response to that? What is your empathetic response to that? So, you know, wrapping things up here, do I think people should be able to defend themselves? Yes, absolutely, 100%. I don't want it to get twisted here that, like, I don't think people should be legally allowed to defend themselves if they feel like their life is being threatened. I just think that we have to be better about how we actually apply that. Do I think Renee should be alive? 100%. Do I think her actions got an appropriate consequence? Like, was the consequence proportionate to her actions? Not in the slightest. It's similar to someone hitting you with a skateboard and you responding by shooting them several times. Do I think her murderer should be charged and convicted? Yes, 100%, go to jail. Do I think he will be? Almost certainly not, and that's the problem. And that's my spiel. So, okay, TikTok Digital Studio audience, what do you guys think? What are your thoughts? We've got about 160 people here. I'll take this opportunity to say shout out to the Patreon community. My Patreon is $1 a month. It's like, it's the best deal in town. All of the content that I make goes there first, early, often with extended content. This podcast is always extended on the Patreon. It gets a longer version of this talk back with the Patreon or with the TikTok Digital Studio audience. So, everything's there. Nothing gets hidden from you by the shitty algorithm. So check it out. If you're watching this on YouTube or if you're watching this over on TikTok right now, subscribe to my YouTube, subscribe to my Patreon. Listen, you guys, I'm getting a little lightheaded. I got to go eat dinner. I'm a hungry, hungry boy. But thank you so much for the lively conversation. My phone's about to die too, so I got to get out of here. Thank you, TikTok Digital Studio audience. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Spotify sucks. Support independent music through Bandcamp. Do it. Check it out. Again, linked in the description of this video. The only way I make money these days is through the support of the people in my audience, the support of the people who like what I do. So I would really just encourage you to consider doing that. It's the only way that, like, work like this survives, because there's not really a market for it anymore. And these platforms are increasingly working hard to censor stuff like this and to keep messages like this down. So if this is important to you, if you want to see channels like this grow and messages like this continue to proliferate, you need to, like, invest in the people, not necessarily just me, but like anybody that you enjoy. And yeah, okay, that's it. That's the show. We'll see you next time. Love you so much. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.